All right, well, this morning is our third and final part in a series, mini series dealing with the transgender movement in our culture. And just as a little review here, in part one, we looked at how we got here as a culture, some of the big ideas and events that led us to become a post-Christian, post-modern, post-truth, post-morality culture. And that included a brief look at the sexual revolution, which began in the early part of the last century and then gained steam in the 60s and 70s, and I would argue continues today, in part shown in this issue of transgenderism. In part two, several weeks ago, we talked about how to love the gender-confused individual. And we said that these folks are not our enemies, they are our neighbors. They should be treated with dignity and respect. Many of them are hurting, even suicidal, and so our hearts go out to them, should go out to them. Loving our gender-confused neighbors does not mean endorsing or celebrating everything they do or encouraging them in their dysphoria. Love doesn't mean that. That's not what love is, just celebrating everything about a person or every decision that they would make. We said that our response should not be yuck or yay, but rather through listening to these individuals, sharing the truth of God's word, sharing the truth which aligns with the biological facts of reality, perhaps we can help them understand that they are indeed male or female and that they should embrace the gender that matches the biological sex with which they were, into which they were born. Talked about the importance of basing truth not on the unstable foundation of our feelings and desires, but on the truth of God's word and the facts of biological reality. We said that it is actually impossible to change one's sex. That's not something you can change your appearance, but you can't change your sex. That's not something that a person is able to do. We also listened to some testimonies of people who had transitioned and then detransitioned back and heard how the steps taken by transgendered individuals are often not only physically harmful, but also emotionally damaging. And some of these lasting effects include infertility, deep regret, depression, and more. And we also said that all individuals, but including transgender individuals, will only find real healing and wholeness through a relationship with Jesus Christ, not through efforts to remake ourselves. This morning, the emphasis will be on engaging the transgender movement as a movement. So part two focused on the individual. This is on the larger movement as it involves law and politics, the workplace, school policies, parental rights, healthcare, and so on. So just as kind of a brief outline, just my two-part outline here. First, I'm going to describe the transgender movement as a movement to you, as an ideology that's sweeping the nation, sweeping the culture, and then discuss how should we respond as Christians to the movement. The cover of the May of 2014 Time magazine had a picture of TV star Laverne Cox. Cox is known as a transgendered woman. She was born biologically male, but has transitioned to live as a woman. The caption reads, "The Transgender Tipping Point, America's Next Civil Rights Frontier." This was a tipping point in that what had been an issue inside the kettle, out of sight, would now be tipped out into the open, would now come to center stage. And this was declared to be a civil rights issue. Who would want to go against the civil rights movement? The following January of 2015, at the next State of the Union address, then-President Barack Obama made the first reference to transgender Americans in any speech by an American president. A few months later, Vanity Fair magazine published the now iconic magazine cover of Bruce Jenner in women's clothes, hair, and makeup with the caption, "Call me Caitlin." These kinds of headlines catapulted the issue of transgenderism right to the forefront of societal issues. This is now the issue. The next phase of the civil rights movement, as they say, the next controversial step of the sexual revolution. Make no mistake, this is a high-powered, well-financed movement supported by wealthy, powerful, influential cultural elites. It is not a fringe movement. It is not an underground movement. And I want to just give you a bit of a snapshot of kind of where things stand. If you pay attention to the news, these will sound familiar, but this is where we're at as a culture. The trans movement is increasingly influencing pop culture, with a growing number of pro-trans movies, TV shows, actors, and musicians, including 2015's The Danish Girl, about a trailblazing man who underwent one of the first so-called sex change operations to become a female. There's also a show on TLC called I Am Jazz, about a transgendered teenager and the adventures of dating, the ongoing process of transitioning, and more. It's also fashionable for corporations to endorse this movement. Perhaps you've noticed that with it being LGBTQ Pride Month right now, including the ultra-influential Google, which had a special doodle on their main page this past week in celebration of June as Pride Month. Google was joined by companies like Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Disney, Nike, Adidas, American Eagle, The Gap, Levi's, Budweiser, Reebok, Target, Macy's, the TV show The View, and many more celebrating Pride Month. Certainly we want to say that individual transgendered people face injustices and crimes. These are sad, heartbreaking, deplorable. The criminals should be brought to justice, those who attack or even kill transgendered individuals. But it would also be a mistake to assume that these instances show a larger systematic oppression of trans individuals. What other persecuted minority has received such resounding support from a nation's largest and wealthiest companies or been so heartily applauded on talk shows? In the area of law and politics, a few weeks back I mentioned a law in New York City which under which you can be fined up to $250,000 for intentionally and consistently using gendered pronouns that don't line up with how a person chooses to identify. At least 20 states have enacted laws which give special protection to LGBTQ+ individuals. And also in March of this year, Representative Nancy Pelosi of California introduced the Equality Act 2019, which would prohibit nationwide any discrimination against a person on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. Regarding gender identity, this bill would become illegal for any facility, including schools, restaurants, businesses, etc., to prevent a person from using a restroom, locker room, or changing room that matches their gender identity. It would also require women's shelters to welcome biological males who identify as trans women, and would require prisons, homeless shelters, college dorms, and more to honor a person's preferred gender identity. The Equality Act was passed by the House of Representatives and now waits in the Senate, where it is expected to be voted down. The Equality Act is supported by the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, and the American Bar Association. So doctors and lawyers that are part of that association. 2020 presidential candidate Joe Biden announced at an event for the Human Rights Campaign in Columbus, Ohio, just last Saturday, that his number one priority, if elected president, would be to enshrine LGBTQ+ rights into federal law via this Equality Act. I'll give you a couple of examples from things going on in the workplace. Perhaps you remember the case of Masterpiece Cake Shop and Christian owner Jack Phillips, that he was sued for not making a cake that was going to celebrate a same-sex wedding. That case went all the way to the Supreme Court. You may not have heard that there was another suit filed against Phillips for refusing to bake a gender transition celebration cake. That suit was filed by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. That suit was later dropped. Phillips had actually filed a counter suit saying that they had targeted him because of his religious convictions, so both suits ended up being dropped, although just this past week I read that he's going back to court again, so they're coming after this guy. In another incident, last year, Peter Vlaming, a high school French teacher from Virginia, was fired for refusing to use a female student's preferred male pronouns after the student began transitioning over the summer. Vlaming had tried to accommodate the student without violating his faith by using the student's new first name and not using any pronouns at all, but this did not satisfy the parents, the principal, or the school board members who wanted Vlaming to use the male pronouns. The school board unanimously voted to fire Vlaming. In the area of sports, several years back, a biological male who identifies as a transgender woman, Fallon Fox, knocked out a biological woman, Tamika Brents, in an MMA fight. The woman, a trained MMA fighter who lost to Fox, had a concussion and a broken skull and later said, "I've never felt so overpowered in my life." What has happened in our culture that we would celebrate an adult man beating up a woman and call it sport? Last year, a woman involved in a world championship cycling event came under fire for complaining when a biological man identifying as a transgender woman won the race. In the area of healthcare and counseling, transgender activists have insisted that these transition surgeries are medically necessary and should be paid for by the government under the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. This is a basic human right, they assert. They should be covered by taxpayer dollars, and in some jurisdictions, they are. And this is all being hashed out still. The number of gender transition clinics for children has exploded over the last couple years from 3 to more than 50. And, of course, these clinics want to stay in business, and so they're quick to recommend transitions. A Catholic hospital in New Jersey was sued for refusing to remove a healthy woman's uterus as part of her transition in 2015. So they sued her for not going, or they sued the hospital. She sued the hospital for not going along with her desire to have her uterus removed. Similar incidents have occurred elsewhere, including a lawsuit filed by the ACLU against a Washington hospital that declined to perform a double mastectomy on a healthy 16-year-old girl who wanted to transition. The implications of the Equality Act for hospitals, medical professionals, and insurance companies is, in their own words, frightening for those who wish to honor their convictions about sex and gender, whether this is from religious conviction or just they have other convictions based on health. Are we losing the PowerPoint here? Because of the cultural momentum of the transgender movement, it is increasingly common for psychologists and therapists to jump right into prescribing transitioning hormones rather than to help a patient with their dysphoria and other underlying issues. In fact, in 20 states, it is now illegal, listen now, it is illegal in 20 states for counselors and therapists to try to help a person with same-sex attraction or a different gender identity to reconcile their feelings in a way other than embracing them. So you can help them as long as the way that you help them is to affirm this is a good thing, this transition is a good thing. These are known as conversion therapy bans, and they exist in 20 states. So here, a therapist risks losing his or her license to counsel the patient in any other way than full acceptance of the gender dysphoria, even for a minor. The therapist seeing a teen involved in self-harm who has anxiety, this counselor is legally unable to say, "Hey, I think you have some other underlying issues that are important to address first." Some trans activists are even pushing for children to be able to get hormone treatments without parental consent. Can you imagine your own child doing an end run around getting hormones without your even knowledge or your consent? In some states, the age of medical consent is actually lowered. So, for example, a 15-year-old in Oregon can start on hormone therapy without the permission or knowledge of their parents, even though these hormone treatments are very experimental, as we saw last week. We just don't know what this is going to do to a person to pump this level of hormones that are unnatural to that body it has to continue for the rest of their life. To pump that amount of hormones unnaturally into a body we've never done this. So as I've alluded to here, this is probably one of the most concerning aspects of the transgender movement, and that is its influence on children and teenagers. The boundaries continue to be pushed earlier and earlier in a child's life regarding when a child can transition and even get sex change surgeries. And so based on what I've been able to discover, I believe the youngest a child has undergone sex reassignment surgery was a 4-year-old from Australia. In the U.S., the number of students who identify as transgendered is in rapid increase. The common number used to be that in a general population, that people who had transgender feelings was about 0.01% of the population. About 1 in 10,000 people experienced these transgender feelings. That number has now increased from 0.01% of the general population to 0.6% of the general population. And among teenagers, or among the age group of 16 to 25, it is as high as 3%, which would be 3 in 100. So from 1 in 10,000 to 3 in 100. And one explanation of this phenomenon, this growth, is that there's always been this number of people, but now, just now that our culture is more accepting, that people feel free to come out as who they really are. The other explanation that I think is more likely is a phenomenon known as peer contagion. Peer contagion. This is basically the idea that coming out as transgendered or non-binary or genderqueer or pangender, that this is trendy among teenagers and young adults. It's trendy, it's fashionable, it's hip. Just as people in the 70s wore bell bottoms, now people come out as some alternative sexuality or gender identity. At some schools, it is reported that entire peer groups are coming out as transgender all at the same time. One parent writes this, and this will come up on the screen if we have that. There we go. He says, as a parent living the nightmare of having a teen who suddenly announces she's transgender, I can tell you there are no doctors who will do anything but agree. There is no science behind this. There is no way to medically diagnose her. Three of her closest friends have already had full transition paid for by their parents, so it is difficult for her to understand why we won't do the same. It is no different than having your child captured by a cult. Not only are children and teens being rewarded by our culture for coming out as trans, but you also have parents who are applauded for being tolerant if they celebrate and affirm their child's dysphoria. And many of them will go right along with the recommendations of the gender clinics to go through with the transitions, again, even though they're not being told of the dangers, the risks of puberty blockers and hormones and surgeries. So what I want to say is that this is not simply an organic movement of teens. It is a direct result of increased cultural pressures and indoctrination. In the summer of 2016, the Obama administration's Department of Education issued their famous Dear Colleague letter to every American school district explaining that Title IX would be interpreted in a way that protects transgender students, giving them access to public restrooms and locker rooms and sports teams of their gender identity. Also want to share with you, this is a document from 2015 called Schools in Transition, a guide for supporting transgender students in K-12 schools. This was jointly produced by the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, the Human Rights Campaign. I mentioned them before. This is the largest LGBTQ plus organization in the country. It was also put out by Gender Spectrum, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and the NEA, the National Education Association. This is the largest teachers union in the country, over 3.2 million members paying dues. In some states they are required to join, in other states they are pressured to join. This combination of organizations issued their recommendation for American public schools, which include this statement. It's a big document, 60-plus pages, fascinating to read. I'm just going to give you a snippet here, but this is what the largest teachers union in the country is recommending to our schools. They say, the expression of transgender identity or any other form of gender expansive behavior is a healthy, appropriate, and typical aspect of human development. A gender-expansive student should never be asked, encouraged, or required to affirm a gender identity or to express their gender in a manner that is not consistent with their self-identification or expression. Any such attempts or requests are unethical and will likely cause significant emotional harm. It is irrelevant whether a person's objection to a student's identity or expression is based on sincerely held religious beliefs or the belief that the student lacks capacity or ability to assert their gender identity or expression, for example, due to age, developmental disability, or intellectual disability. In other words, if you have religious convictions about this, or if you have concerns about a student or an athlete's ability to make this kind of decision based on their developmental, where they're at, it is unethical to even ask or question this asserted gender identity. There are also reports of schools changing policies regarding transgender students without notifying parents. You'd think that would be something that parents should be able to know, should have a right to know about their school district, but that's not always the case. There are also increasingly so-called protections for students that identify as transgendered so that parents are not required even to be notified if their children are identifying as a different gender at school. Can you imagine finding out, perhaps from another parent, that everyone has been calling your child by a different name at school for the past 6 months, and you didn't even know they were identifying as a different gender? There are even several incidents in Canada and here in the States, including one in Ohio, down in Hamilton County, Cincinnati area, in which teenage children have been removed from their parents by Child Protective Services because the parents didn't support their kids' transitions. In the case in Cincinnati, the parents were Christians and objected to the transition on moral, biblical grounds. The story reads, Hamilton County Judge Sylvia Siv Hendon granted custody to the girl's maternal grandparents who are open to transgender hormone therapy. The teenager has been living with them since 2016. There are more headlines like these almost daily as this ideology is being pushed on our children. For example, California now includes in their curriculum teaching about gender identity at all levels, including kindergarten, where kids will be told that they are not necessarily boys or girls, but that they could be born in the wrong body, that they could change their gender to a different one, or they could be both, or they could be neither. And perhaps the teachers will be using the gender unicorn, which is a popular tool for teaching kids about gender identity. A teen girl in Connecticut who runs sprint events and track came in third place at the state meet to two runners who had previously competed as males but now identify as female. It's also increasingly popular for public libraries to feature sessions where drag queens come in and read books about gender identity to kids. And then several weeks back, the PBS children's show Arthur featured a same-sex wedding between Arthur's teacher, Mr. Ratburn, and his male partner. I want to ask some questions. Do we think that kids are capable of making these kinds of assessments about their identity? Are kids capable of making decisions about their bodies that they will have to live with, really, for the rest of their lives? When I was little, I wanted to be, at one point, a raccoon, a panda. I wanted to be a ninja. I wanted to be a Native American. And I'm thankful that my parents didn't encourage me to embrace wholeheartedly that identity. Kids are vulnerable. They are foolish. They'll believe anything, really. Parents know that. In what other area, in what other important area, do we let children be the experts and believe everything they say? Even for teenagers, should we trust them with these kinds of decisions? We don't even let them buy cigarettes until they're 18, but we'll let them fill their bodies with hormones and get irreversible surgeries, even though we know that for the vast majority, these feelings will statistically, these feelings will go away. Do we really think that children and teenagers have the wisdom and discretion to make these kinds of decisions? Do we want to give them this power and responsibility to alter reality? If we won't deny them the power to declare their own gender, why not also give them the power to declare their own species, to declare their own race, to declare their own math facts, to declare their own bank statement, to declare their own moral standards, no matter how bizarre they are? And so many are now concerned that we are systematically pushing gender confusion, pushing dysphoria, which not long ago was considered a mental disorder, that we are pushing this on our children through this movement. We're concerned that our culture is overemphasizing personal autonomy, self-rule, to even alter one's own body and get medically unnecessary surgeries, that we are overemphasizing the power of a person to determine their own reality, simply by their own thoughts and feelings. Have we thought through the long-term impact of this kind of training for a generation of children? Having received this sexual worldview education for their entire childhood, what will this generation of students not be open to? Will there be any sexual boundaries at all when these children are all grown up? Why would we think that they will have any worldview tools to take a stand for anything other than personal autonomy and living out one's desires, whatever they are? I want to draw your attention to several other features of this movement, and we'll go fairly quickly through this. The first one is obviously a disregard for the human body. This is a kind of Gnosticism, not valuing the physical, seeing one's physical body as malleable or even as an enemy. And we want to say, we want to offer an alternative that the Bible, on the other hand, sees the physical body as good. It's something from God to be thankful for and over which we're to be stewards. And so Christianity can offer to the secular world a robust body positive view. Another feature of this movement is that really it is a reversion. It is a regressive movement. It is a reversion to paganism. Though people call this movement progressive, some even non-Christian commentators have noted that this is not really a step forward, but a step backwards. In other words, cultures have tried this before. And so I want to say we, as a culture, we're so progressive that we're actually regressive. In the era before Christ, people of pagan cultures, for example, sacrificed their children and had legal prostitution. The Roman Empire had free love and sexual slavery and homosexuality. And it was actually the Christian sexual ethic that liberated people, especially women and children, from the consequences, the destruction that was wreaked by this what they call liberation. There's actually a form of captivity. And so I just want to say that, you know, for all the talk about how progressive this is and how wonderfully accepting and liberating this is actually a move backwards. And so I think we should be against things that call themselves progress, but are actually damaging to people, especially children and others who are vulnerable. That's not liberation. I think it's always moving away from liberation to embrace something other than God's design. Real freedom is found in Christ and following God's design. Another feature of this movement is that it's aided by technology. As you know, most teens now have access to every conceivable idea right in the palm of their hand on their phones. And I was just thinking about this week, you know, my heart would ache for a teen girl, maybe a 13-year-old girl who maybe doesn't have a dad in her life and she's insecure about her body anyway. Perhaps she's bullied at school and maybe depressed. And she comes home and on her phone starts watching videos and watches I Am Jazz on TV and finds a transgender channel on YouTube and starts to think, yes, this is the answer. This is why I haven't fit in. This is why things feel so wrong in my life. And so technology pushes the agenda forward. Just want to say something briefly about this. There's a lot to say about this next point, the contradictions involved in this movement. And I'll just mention one. There are a number here. But, for example, this movement, for being so progressive, it actually contradicts the secular feminism that we've seen. The secular feminists have always said that womanhood is good, and, you know, womanhood, and women are powerful and all this. But actually, the transgender movement contradicts that by saying there's actually no such thing as womanhood. Womanhood is not even a thing. There's actually no gender. The whole binary thing, it's all this spectrum. And so there's actually no such thing as womanhood at all. And so there's this contradiction between the feminist movement and the transgender movement. And I would say that a lot of things that traditional feminists would have seen as good things, like Title IX sports, sports just for girls and women, that those things are now being reversed, right? And so I wonder if the feminists will be happy when men are not only winning their own sports, but now coming into women's sports and in some cases winning those events too. I wonder if the feminists are troubled that some of the safe spaces that have been set aside for women, like women's shelters and locker rooms, that these are all being given up as safe spaces. Another feature to mention here is, tyranny or an authoritarian kind of thing going on. Remember, we said it in postmodernism, the view is that kind of anything goes. Every person gets to decide their right, what's right and wrong for them. But it seems that human beings aren't capable of living that out consistently. They can't really live with no rules and no order. And so in this postmodern age, what kind of fills the gap, what steps into that, is the state, the government. A very powerful authoritarian streak going on here now. The state now determines reality. The government gives us our rights, not God. If you come out now and say you oppose the transgender movement, you're going to be immediately labeled as transphobic and bigoted, and not just punished by internet trolls, but even by the government in some cases, as we looked at there with these folks who have lost their jobs and been sued and that kind of thing. So it's actually the state that is growing in power. And so this authoritarian impulse, it's not just that we want you to persuade you of this view. We are going to punish you if you don't have this view. If you don't fully embrace and celebrate transgenderism as fully healthy and normal and good, then we're going to fine you, you're going to lose your job, there will be penalties. Perhaps you've heard that Chick-fil-A restaurants were forced to close in publicly owned airports in San Antonio, Texas, and Buffalo, New York, because of the CEO, Dan Cathy's, Christian convictions about sexuality. There are no reports of mistreatment or injustice towards same-sex attracted people or transgendered people in these restaurants. The owner simply has the wrong view. And he's not allowed to have that view, according to the new thought police. They wanted to punish him. So if you don't align with the secular crowd, you will be labeled, again, a transphobic bigot. You are on the wrong side of history, and you are now a target. So how ironic that the culture that proclaims itself, we're so open and tolerant, has now become increasingly tyrannical. I'll just say, kind of in my own thinking on this, if an adult wants to use his or her own money and time to live as the opposite gender, I think they should be able to do that legally. I don't think it's right. I don't think that they'll find fullness and joy that way. And honestly, again, my heart breaks for them. But I think they should be allowed to live that way if they want. I will love that person. I will treat them with dignity. There will be no name calling. I certainly won't physically attack them. I will serve them, be glad to talk with them, love them as my neighbor. But I don't think that person's example should be paraded in our culture as an example of health and flourishing. Certainly not an option that we should offer, that should be offered to or promoted with our children. And I also don't think that those examples should be used to bully parents, employers, doctors, teachers, taxpayers, and everyone else to go against their consciences as professionals or as simply fellow citizens. So I propose that our response to this movement as followers of Jesus is to oppose this movement, to oppose this growing ideology. It is not out of hate, it is not out of fear, but out of love that I think we should do so. And someone might ask, well, how can you love a person, as we talked about last time, how can you love the person but oppose their movement? And I'll say we do this all the time, and I want to give you just two examples. If I meet someone who is addicted to heroin, I am called to love them, to show mercy and grace to them, and if possible, to minister the gospel to them, to help them become healthy in their body and mind, to break that addiction. And because I love that heroin-addicted individual, I would also oppose the movement that is helping keep them in that bondage, in that addiction. And so I would support measures to keep drugs from coming into our country, to crack down on heroin dealers or other means of pushing back the movement. And again, it would not be out of hatred for that individual that I oppose that movement. It would be out of love that I would oppose that movement. If someone comes into our church who has been divorced and is now remarried, I am called to love that person, to extend mercy and grace, to help them reconcile to the degree possible the broken relationships from their past and to help strengthen their current marriage. And because of my love for that person and his family and others like them, I would oppose the movement of divorce in our country. I teach against divorce from the Bible here on Sundays and with our teens and in counseling with couples preparing to get married. I love the divorced individual, and because I love them, I also oppose the divorce movement, because I understand divorce to be dishonoring to God and against his design for marriage, bad for the couple and especially for any children involved. You could give other examples. The idea here is that you can, it is possible, it's something we do, to love the individual but to oppose the movement. And so with transgenderism, I don't love the transgender individual, but hate the movement. I love the transgender individual, and because I love them and others in their shoes, I also oppose the movement. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 6. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love, we read here, rejoices with the truth. I think Christians ought to oppose this movement that encourages people to embrace an identity other than how God made them. Just as I think it's unloving for me to celebrate someone who wants to try to change their race, that's transracial. Just as I would oppose someone who wants to live as another species, trans species, or for a healthy person to identify as disabled, yes, that's a phenomenon, that's transabled. I think it's unloving for me to celebrate someone who wants to live out of alignment with the reality of their body. I think it would be unloving of me to support a war between their body and their mind. I think it's unloving for me to celebrate people pumping unnatural hormones into their bodies. I think the most loving thing that I could do would be to oppose a movement that encourages people to undergo expensive, painful, medically unnecessary, and irreversible surgeries that always have complications and do not address the underlying issues and can never even give them the outcomes they want anyway. Love is not proud. I do not think it's loving to help people be proud when that means celebrating something that goes against God's design. I do not think it's loving to support an ideology that encourages self-indulgence, giving in to your sexual urges in order to be an authentic version of yourself. Love does not delight in evil. I think self-control and self-restraint are virtues. I believe God gave us boundaries on sex, not out of hate, but out of his perfect love, and that for me to love, I should try to live by and encourage others to live by these same boundaries. Love always protects. I think it would be unloving for us to fail to protect women, especially young girls and women who are survivors of sexual assault, by having an open bathroom policy that allows biological men to come into their restrooms and watch them change or shower, or to come into their prisons and homeless shelters and dorm rooms in a way that violates their privacy and security. I am not saying that all transgendered individuals do this or want to do this. I am saying that there are people out there who would take advantage of these kinds of policies to act in ways that are harmful to these girls and women, and it has happened. It is documented to have happened in the places where these policies have been put into effect. I can get you those if you're interested. I don't think it's loving to allow a girl who's worked hard in her sport to get beat in her event and potentially to miss out on a college scholarship because biological males want to compete in her event. I don't think it's loving to allow a government to force business owners and teachers to violate their consciences, or to force taxpayers to pay for procedures they are against, or to force a surgeon to perform a surgery she doesn't think is in the best interest of the patient, or to require a therapist, by law, to recommend treatment he knows will not bring real healing but will very likely make things worse. I don't think it's loving to give this much power to the state, to government officials, sinners, to give them the power to determine a reality that goes against objective biological reality. I think that is very dangerous for a nation and its citizens. I think it would be especially unloving of me to support a movement that pushes confusion into the minds of our kids. When so much is already uncertain in this world, to encourage otherwise innocent children who don't know hardly anything about these things, to cause them to doubt who they are, to get them wondering if they really are a boy or a girl, or maybe both, or neither, if that could change, to introduce to undeveloped minds that possibility, how could we lovingly let this happen? I think the loving thing to do is to rejoice with the truth of who God made them to be thankful for the body he gave us. And so our response here, just in four points. How should we live in light of these times, in light of this movement? First, with genuine compassion for all people. I mentioned this, emphasized this in the last sermon. We are called to love our neighbor. We are called to love God and love our neighbor. And so I encourage you, if you hear these things, the state of our culture, and you're frustrated or angry or whatever emotion that brings about in you, we must not let our fears or frustrations about this movement keep us from loving the individual. We must love our neighbor. That is who God has called us, what God has called us to do. We are to love those who are hurting. But number two, to balance that, we should respond with biblically informed conviction and courageous opposition to an ungodly and unloving movement. The scriptures call Christians to go against the world, not against the world nature, but against the fallen world system. Romans 12:2 says, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." For Christians, accommodation, going along with the crowd, going along with the movement, if it contradicts what the Bible teaches, this is not an option for us. 1 John 2, verses 15 through 17, "Do not love the world or anything in it. Or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever." So we are warned in Scripture, encouraged in this way, to not go with the flow, to not conform to the world, but to stand strong, to stand firm on biblical convictions. There is this pressure. I feel it. You feel it. This movement is being pushed into every sphere, every sector of our lives. And it will only increase, I believe, that pinch will be felt. Jesus said in Luke 6:26, "Woe to you when all men speak well of you." Woe to you when all men speak well of you. To just go along with the crowd so you can get that affirmation and that applause. Oh, look how tolerant. We are called to be light. We are called to be salt in the world. We are called to be in the world, but not of the world. And so how do we do this? We can't be loud and shrill, enraged, obnoxious, but instead to speak the truth with wisdom, boldly, but with compassion. We should not expect Christians to act according to biblical standards, but we can persuade them of the goals for the common good on these kinds of issues. We should be in prayer. We should be in prayer about this kind of issue for our own lives, for our own families, for our church. We should stay informed. We should continue to proclaim the truth here from this pulpit on Wednesdays in life group with our kids. You know that there are many churches who are folding on this issue and issues like it. I mentioned the episode of Arthur that was apparently blocked in the state of Alabama, but a United Methodist Church in Alabama hosted a screening of that show, the Arthur show, with the same-sex wedding. Invited the whole neighborhood and had a big wedding cake to celebrate. This is something that churches are folding on left and right as they become untethered from the Word of God as their source, as their standard. We need to be politically involved to know who we're voting for, what issues candidates are promoting. When it comes to school involvement, do you know if you have children in school, do you know what the policies are? Do you know what's being taught in health class? And if you come across something that you have a concern about based on your convictions, would you respond? Would you do anything about it? I think this is something that we really need to think through and encourage one another. Yeah, we need to take a stand. If we don't take a stand, this movement will continue, just plowing over. I think it's appropriate to get behind others who are doing good work in this area. And just want to mention a few to you. The Heritage Foundation, the ACLJ, American Center for Liberty and Justice, I believe, and then the Family Research Council. So I just want to say, this is not a time to shrink back. This is a time to stand firm, even if it means that there's a cost. And a third response is that we should respond with high devotion to personal purity. With high devotion to personal purity. So we should love the individuals. We should oppose the movement courageously. We also need to pursue high devotion to personal purity in our own life. It is easy when the standards are always shifting and the momentum is all away from God's standards that we stand firm on this. If we try to take a stand on this issue or any issue that's contrary to where our culture is going and they see in us hypocrisy, it guts us of our authority. It guts us of our credibility. If we want to be taken seriously, we must be people of sexual integrity. They need to see in us the best marriages, the greatest joy, the greatest love for our kids. And so we need to be careful about what we watch, what we support, what we give our money to, what we give our time to. Consider your involvement in some of the organizations that I mentioned before that are promoting this movement. Do I want to give my money? I mean, it's almost impossible to not spend money somewhere that's going towards this. But it is something we need to think through. And a last response, so to love the individual, to oppose the movement, to pursue personal purity, and finally, we need to have joyful contentment, confident of God's faithfulness. And I'll just say, this is a heavy thing. As I've read books and articles and pieced through this here over these last couple months preparing for this series, it is a scary time, I think. It is a concerning time for anybody that has biblical convictions. And I want to say that there's that part of you that wants to panic, and we mustn't. We mustn't panic. This is not a time to panic. God is sovereign. Christ is on the throne. He is with us. He loves us. This is not the end of the world. If you lose your job or you face a hefty fine, that will not be the end of the world. The Apostle Paul faced worse, and yet he said he had found the secret. He had found the secret to contentment, whether he was well-fed or hungry. No matter what circumstances he faced, he had found the secret to contentment. And it's finding your identity in Christ. It's the gospel. It's knowing that you are unconditionally loved by a loving Father who will protect you, who will protect us. And so we're able to have that kind of unshakable joy. I'm going to invite our music team. We're going to close with the song, O Church Arise. And I want this to be our prayer. God, help us to rise up. As you know, our worldview is not the majority view. God's people in the West are starting to get a taste of what they experienced in ancient Babylon and first century Rome and still face today in other countries. For Christians to be the minority view. This is not the world you grew up in. It is not the world maybe that you prefer, but it is the world in which God has placed us. He's brought us and put us here for such a time as this, to engage our world in love, to love people, to love and protect children, even when that is unpopular. Jesus continued to love even when his love was interpreted as hate, and we must do the same. If we believe that this book is true, then we must take our stand with it and with the God who gave it to us.